gang, welcome to another exciting episode of National Beagle Radio on the Republic Broadcasting Network, RBN, republicbroadcasting.org. It's your grab bag of free speech, because you never know what you're going to grab. You know how it is when you just, like, grab at something, and, you know, who knows what it is. When Donald Trump grabs at things, you don't even know what they are, okay? He doesn't know what they are. And yet he's able to grab at things. He's able to grab at all sorts of things. Well, we do that at RBN. We grab, and it's a grab bag, and you can grab some free speech for free, except that it's expensive. So go to republicbroadcasting.org, click on the donate button, grab yourself some free speech. Follow the instructions. Also, grab yourself some Koshertified app, right? Grab it by the app. You can do that. You know, when you are enlightened, when you are non-kosher certified, you can just walk up to certain individuals and grab them by the app. So that's what you want to do. Go to nationalbugle.com and grab that app. It's right there. It's there for the grabbing. All right. Yesterday, Philbert and I were talking about Noam Chomsky and, you know, other assorted individuals and narratives, and we continued our discussion after the show. It was recording, and with his permission, I'm going to be airing it. So that's what you're going to hear first, and then after the break, I'm going to be playing some Jeffrey Sachs. I'll explain why after the break, but without further delay, here's Philbert.
I know it went down a little bit at, like, World War II, you know, but, like, it's barely a dip. And, you know, that was all white people that died. It wasn't including any non-whites at all. It was all virtually all Europeans.
I mean, there were Chinese people.
Right. Yeah. I don't want to. But the majority of them, I mean, the dip, majority white. Yeah. There's a lot of Chinese that died.
Yeah.
Too.
A lot of Russians died. And, you know, a lot of the time they don't put the Chinese into World War II because
Right. There were like 10 million or so Chinese that died or more. And I don't think they correctly. I don't know. You probably know. Did they correctly point out the? I don't even think they got the Hiroshima right. I know a lot of people say they don't.
Well, you know, how do you
underestimate the Japanese too?
People died within a week. People who died within a month. People who died within a year.
Right. So they're including the people that passed right away.
Yeah, there are elevated cancer deaths, and there are still some people who are alive today who experienced it.
That's so unfortunate. That's just.
But so when I was a kid, after having gone to the Smithsonian and seeing this parabolic shaped curve representing population, as a kid I started thinking, well, okay, well, you know, when you get down to it, lots of people on Earth, you know, they may produce to an extent, but they're producing for themselves or producing for their village. They're not really producing a surplus in terms of building civilization, and then they're consuming a lot. And of course, you have a lot of people who are consuming without producing. And I was thinking, if you had a society without the consumers who don't produce, and then B, if you could reduce it further by not having people who are just simply kind of producing for their peers who aren't really creating a surplus. That you could probably get the world population way down, but still have technology, still have civilizational advance. Yeah, I thought of that, but I thought, of course, well, how are you going to do that? What are you going to do? You're going to kill people? You're going to sterilize people? How do you actually do that? And I remember in the mid 1970s, Indira Gandhi, who was the Prime Minister of India, she actually did this. And this was before the Chinese had started their draconian population control program. She was giving out transistor radios to men in exchange for them having vasectomies. But they didn't really – the men often, you know, these were illiterate men, and they didn't know what they were getting into. Yeah, and that led to her downfall. She was forced out of office. She eventually came back and then was assassinated – by, I think, her Sikh bodyguards for separate reasons. But I remember that. And so it's like, well, like philosophically or theoretically, you could reduce the world's population down to 1 billion or half a billion or
something like that, and maintain, you know, a high level of civilization, and people could travel around the world, and, you know, you'd have technology and everything. But how do you get from here to there? And even something as relatively innocuous as sterilization, well, that didn't work in India. No. So how are you going to get there?
Well, I mean, it kind of barely worked in China.
It did work in China.
Yeah, well, their population is kind of dropping like a rock now, isn't it? It's almost as bad as the whites. Yet,
but it will. The Japanese population is dropping. So, you know, one thing I remember in the 80s when I was studying, I was taking an international economy class. And, you know, up until then, I'd been very much a population alarmist. But what was becoming clear in the 1980s was the birth rates in developed countries were falling. And that in newly developed countries, they were also slowing down. And it seemed that, okay, well, if people, you know, countries that develop economically, what happens is the women, you know, the women enter the workforce, they go to college, they enter the workforce, they delay reproduction. Also, you get, in developed countries, you wind up getting social security programs where people's medical and pension needs are met by the state. Right. And that takes away the need for having, you know, seven or eight children, because in Africa or India, you'd have seven or eight children because you had high infant mortality. And the only way to make sure that you were going to have children who could take care of you, like if you just had two children, there was a very strong likelihood that by the time you got old, you wouldn't have any children left to take care of you because of infant mortality or childhood mortality or other things.
Africa, it was starvation that largely kept that under control, as far as I'm aware of.
So,
but now, like, we feed them nonstop. Like,
well, yeah. So, but at any rate, I remember in the 80s reading about this and thinking, okay, so then the answer is spreading development everywhere, and that will lead to slower birth rates. And China kind of leapfrogged, because China slowed its birth rate before its development, and in fact, it was Deng Xiaoping's idea that the only way to development was by slowing the birth rate. So, like in other countries, you would look; they would have very high population growth rates while they were developing, and then once they developed, the birth rates would go down. You'd look at a place like South Korea would be an example of that. But China leapfrogged that, and they got their population under control. And I guess, you know, part of it is children are kind of expensive. The education's expensive. And so there was probably a short-term payoff where they still had lots and lots of people in their productive years, and they were supporting fewer children. But now the problem is...
I mean, don't you think, like, biology comes into it also? I was like, I would agree. Well, isn't it, like, what is it called? The Y versus K theory or whatever? Like, where one... like, say, sea turtles, they have, like, what, 17, like, shells, yeah, you know, and hopes of that, like...
Is it R versus K? I think, is it R versus
K? Oh, R versus K? Okay, right. So you know what I'm talking about. But, like, don't you think, like, there's that when we're talking about, like, Asians and whites may be the, you know, on the one side, and then...
I could be wrong on the letters, I could be wrong on what they represent.
Right, I don't know which one it is either.
The idea is that there's one strategy where you have fewer children and higher investment in raising the children. Yeah. And the other is where you have more children but little investment in raising them. So, you know, sea turtles.
It seems like blacks just, you know, have whatever the strategy of having the, you know, the most is.
I think that's
there's definitely a biological factor in it, I see.
Yeah, well, I mean, so if you look at different species, you look at sea turtles you mentioned who come, they lay hundreds of eggs on the shore, and then they go back into the ocean, and they do nothing to take care of their babies. Their babies eventually hatch, and they try to scamper back into the sea, but seagulls are there already, and seagulls eat most of them, but some of them scamper back and then eventually get big. Whereas you look at an orangutan, where they have the one child at a time, and there's a lot of time goes into nursing and developing the child. And of course, humans are extremely like that, but if you break down different cultures, some, you know, and not just different cultures, but the same groups of people, but at different times. So you know, people in Britain, the working class in Britain, or people in America, or people in Japan. I mean, even when I was a kid, a lot of the families in my neighborhood had 6 or 8 or 10 kids. You had a baby boom for a generation. But in the early, like, American frontier, you had very high birth rates. You had that. So I'm not even sure if that's how genetic it is. But the thing is, with Africa, you just – nothing seems to be able to get their birth rate down. But, of course, the other thing is nothing ever seems to be able to get their development rates up. They don't – you know, they urbanize, but they urbanize at low development rates. And so I don't know. I mean, at any rate, the African population is just booming, and they're with no end in sight. And the Chomskys of the world just seem to think that white countries should just totally give way, should you know, hand over all their resources, hand over their women, hand over their land, hand over everything to Africans, and we should just accept our own extinction because we were mean.
Yeah, or perceived as being mean. Like...
But, you know, there's a lack of honesty there. Because the thing is, we know when Jews have control over another population, they can be very ruthless. And you look at the way Jews control the Palestinians. And the Israelis are somewhat restrained because of international opinion. But imagine a world in which, let's just flash forward 50 years or so, where all of the white countries no longer have white majorities, but they have beleaguered white minorities that are like 30% or less in very multiracial, multicultural countries dominated by Jews.
You're on it. You fucking spot on. That's why they want us gone. You're exactly right.
And then what happens? And once you have and if you have complete Jewish dominance around the world, and there's no China or no, you know, I don't know if India would ever be a match for them, but the Chinese possibly could be. But once they have total control, why aren't they going to go Gaza on basically the rest of the world?
That's their plan. I mean, if you read their religious texts, and I honestly haven't read all of it, I don't understand all of it. I don't want to pretend like I do, but probably more than your average person. That's what they want to do. Like they truly believe, like, every Jew after their Moshiach comes, every Jew will have 2,100 non-Jewish slaves. Like there are a lot of them that like truly believe that. There are a great deal, you know, that are atheistic that are like, yeah, whatever, yeah, but we still need to take over the world. I may not have 2,100 slaves, but yeah, we still need to take over the world. Like it's ridiculous. So I mean, I believe you. I believe you're right. I believe you're spot on.
Well, I mean, I'm just saying that's a possible scenario. And the thing about somebody like Noam Chomsky is he's just not – either he's not being honest, or more likely it's kind of
I feel it's just in their blood. Like they can't help it. It's in their blood.
Well, I was going to say it's a lifetime of self-deception. They're very skilled at self-deception. They're very skilled at blocking out information or, you know, narratives, understandings that don't suit them. They just completely block them out. They you know, they not only do they censor these ideas from public discussion, but they censor their own minds so they don't have to deal with them.
Right, like self-censoring.
You know, one thing that was very interesting that Noam Chomsky blurted out, because he was trying to rag on the Europeans, and he said. He was saying that he was alarmed at what was going on in France. He said he was glad that Jean, what's her name? Marine Le Pen, that she lost the election, but he was alarmed at the rightward movement of Macron. Like, I don't even know what that means. But, well, I know in Noam Chomsky, because Noam Chomsky is like everything bad that really is the fault of the Jews. In his mindset, everything bad that the Jews do is actually because of corporations. That's his whole thing.
Like, and you know what Dr. Duke pointed out? I never, Dr. Duke made one of his videos years ago, probably 10 years ago or more. He pointed out that Chomsky will always be critical of Israel, but he'll never be critical of the Jews that control like America. And I'm like, no shit. I didn't realize that until he pointed that out. It's so true.
Exactly, exactly. I mean, Chomsky, there's a lot of things Chomsky says that I agree with. I think he's very perceptive where he chooses to perceive things. But then
I used to watch RT a lot, and when I watched it, he was always on RT, and I kind of liked him because he was always critical of Israel, and, you know, I'm like, oh, this guy's smart, and he's Jew, too, you know, but, like, then up until the point where I started to listen to Dr. Duke and read about Dr. Duke, kind of had second thoughts about the asshole.
Well, like, he's a mixed bag, but he has blinders, he wears blinders, and where was I going with this? So what he was pointing out about France, he's alarmed at the rightward lurch of France, but he brought up that Vichy. He said, Vichy France. Vichy was very popular. Like, okay, why were Nazi collaboration parties in France and other places in Europe, why were they so popular? It wasn't just in Germany. It was all over Europe. There are a lot of people who agreed with at least what they thought Hitler was about. And Hitler was even if he didn't do a Holocaust of 6 million people being masturbated to death in fake shower rooms or whatever, he was explicitly anti-Semitic. I mean, he was blaming a lot of problems on Jews. And I think to a very large extent, maybe not entirely, but to a very large extent, correctly. And a lot of people in Europe at the time who were perceiving things around them agreed. And so if Chomsky is going to say that that Vichy and other collaborationist groups in most European countries were very popular, okay, fine. Why not address why that might be so? And I tried to do this. This is what I was trying to do in the show we just recorded. You know, it's like I can talk about gun control, and I can say, well, yeah, if you removed guns, you would probably have less mass shootings, or if climate change is actually happening. But I try to look at it comprehensively. I still have my position. I'm able to handle, deal with, and address the points raised by other people. But that's the thing about Chomsky is, you know.
Yeah, well, he starts the story in the middle. It reminds me of these Jewish movies that they make, right? They start the story in the middle. They want you to believe that, like, Hitler was a crazy, wacky maniac that woke up one morning and wanted to kill 6 million Jews. And that's not the case at all.
Yeah, no. And the thing is, like, for myself, I'm really not, like, on a personal level, I'm not anti-Jewish. I don't see Jews as being, like, really, really disagreeable people. You know, I'm not particularly anti-black, but like it can be harder to get along with blacks. You can get along with blacks, but being around a whole bunch of blacks,
You got to be careful.
You got to be careful. But Jews, you know, I get along just fine with Jews, but I do recognize the like certain personality tendencies that are prevalent, not necessarily universal, but prevalent. And there's an ethnocentrism, there's a kind of paranoia, and, you know, they have this behavior, and they're just not willing to be introspective. And, you know, it's for Chomsky or for anybody else, it's just a given that Hitler was an evil and anti-Semitism is irrational, and they're not, and therefore they don't need to deal with Jewish group behavior. And in fact, it's not Chomsky that does this. I can't remember. I have seen this before. Jews writing that because the Goyim are going to be irrationally anti-Semitic, because they are going to do that, there is no point for Jews not to behave in an adversarial manner.
Well, it says that in the Talmud, I believe.
It probably does.
One of the Sanhedrins, it says that very obviously. Or, I mean, I'm sure not just one spot. The whole thing is rife full of that crap. But, I mean, you would be hard-pressed to find the Torah or the Talmud not say that. I can't exactly quote it. I'm glad we're not recording right now. But I'm pretty sure I've read that quote before.
Well, by the way, because it was kind of interesting, I did turn the record button back on just in case. So I don't know if you
want to... Right on. So you could edit some in if you want.
I could edit some into the Friday show.
Well, that's not a bad idea.
Consider this. Dead people see only what they want to see. And frankly, most of us are still dead. Let me give you the lessons of gold and five easy lessons. Number one, don't buy it because you need to make money. You buy gold because you need to protect the money you already have. Don't ever look at the price as a barrier. Look at it as an incentive. Number three, don't buy its paper pretenders. We talked about that a lot. Buy gold. Buy the real thing in the form of coins and bullion. Fourth, don't fall prey to glitzy television or Facebook ads. Do your due diligence instead. And that's what I try to provide you with and have for 26 and a half years on the air and 30 years in this profession. Fifth, don't allow naysayers to divert your interest. Allow yourself the right to protect your interests as you see fit. Jeff Bennett here. One of the ways you can do that is to contact Kettle Moraine Limited. Contact me by calling or texting me at 602-799-8214. 602-799-8214. You can also email me at kettlemoraineltd@cox.net. Let me help you protect your wealth and your family today. Once again, call or text us at 602-799-8214 or visit our website, Sierra Madre Precious Metals.com. Be glad to help you out. Be glad to answer your questions. That's what we're here for. No pressure, just good, hard, common sense. The decision then becomes up to you.
American Freedom News is your daily website that will keep you fully informed on what both the good guys and bad guys are doing in the information war in which we are all engaged. Fed up with the lies of the fake news media and the censorship of big tech giants? American Freedom News is the solution, as we provide truth and knowledge on all the vital issues of the day. American Freedom News believes in America first. The establishment wants us split into numerous hostile groups rather than uniting in a common cause against the corrupt oligarchy that is plundering America and the world. Many more Americans are waking up and realizing they are the victims of the ongoing Great Replacement and Great Reset. But the malevolent forces trying to systematically destroy America can and will be defeated. Be fully informed by reading American Freedom News, the best news and information site on the internet. Go to AmericanFreedomNews.us and find out for yourself. That's AmericanFreedomNews.us.
Okay, welcome back to the show. All right, so I'm going to try to cram in Jeffrey Sachs, an interview with him on some ecological or environmental podcast. And the reason is you've got... Right now, you've got this war going on. What's it all about? It's all about this Jewish effort to overthrow Vladimir Putin. Now, the thing is, the people who are running our foreign policy, who are running the war right now, Victoria Nuland in particular, but you know, you got Antony Blinken, Wendy Sherman, you got people in Congress like what's the other guy's name? Adam Schiff, or Gerald Nadler. Or in the Senate, Chuck Schumer, you know, a bunch of Jews and the Jews in the media. Honestly, these are not the Jews' A team. Now, recently, you've had people like Henry Kissinger. Fulbert and I were talking about Noam Chomsky earlier, and now Jeffrey Sachs, who are definitely the Jews' intellectual A team. Now, I'm not saying that these are the good guys, but they are talking a lot more sense on what's going on in Russia. And I think they know that this is insane, our policy is insane, and if you're a thinking Jew, it's not going to be good for the Jews. To have a failing war, because the war is going to fail. Their objectives are going to fail. It's not going to be good for the Jews. It's not going to be good for very many people, but it's certainly not going to be good for the Jews. And so they're trying to walk it back. So Jeffrey Sachs is actually talking a lot of sense. I'm not promoting Jeffrey Sachs because I think he was the architect of the privatization in Russia that created the Jewish oligarch class. So he is not a good character, but he is somebody who can talk sense. And he's somebody also who, like a lot of these people, may have a talent for self-deception and may not actually think they're doing evil stuff. They may think they've got very good reasons for doing things. I think there's a lot of self-deception going on. We can talk about that another day, but
But without further delay, I'm going to cram this interview in there at slightly accelerated speed, and I'll be back again next week with more exciting episodes of National Bugle Radio.
Professor Jeffrey Sachs is the president of the UN Sustainable Development Solutions Network, as well as the director of the Center for Sustainable Development at Columbia University. Professor Sachs, welcome back to the Climate Pod.
Great to be back with you. Thank you.
Well, I'm going to get into the current war that's unfolding between Russia and Ukraine. But first, let's take a step back. You've had a long history working in Russia as an advisor to Presidents Gorbachev and Yeltsin, going back to the 1980s and 90s. What did you learn from that experience that's still relevant now as we try to better understand the relationship between Russia, the United States, and the rest of Europe?
Thanks a lot for a good starting question, because I learned how fraught the relationship is. Of course, I came in at the end of the Cold War. I thought, oh, this is a miracle. Here I am sitting in the Kremlin. You know, this was not a Cold War normal period. But I saw that Cold War thinking remained very strong on the American side. I think it remains strong until today. I bemoan that. You know, I started working with Gorbachev, who was so innovative. I mean, it was basically he reimagined the whole world in ways that few people understood or agreed with on his side or on our side. But he thought, what are we doing? We share a common geography in Eurasia. We need to have peace. So Gorbachev said, we're going to have massive political reform. Of course, you know, when you're coming out of a repressive system, all hell can break loose. And it did in certain ways, in certain places, war and huge disputes. But I thought, oh, my God, this is a chance for real cooperation. My main point in the early 1990s was the United States should help make the transformation of the Soviet Union or of Russia to a democratic and more open and more market-based economic system. But basically what I said fell on deaf ears, mostly in the United States, not so much in Russia. Russia was kind of open to, well, if that's the right way to go. But in the United States, help them? Are you kidding? That was the view. And I regard that basically as the underlying deep source of our problems since then. We just want to be in control. The United States, it's a kind of mentality that goes way back. It's the American exceptionalism. It is the deep belief of many Americans and also at the top of the system that the world is only safe if America runs the show. And I don't see things that way. My view is other people don't want to be run by outsiders. They want to run their own affairs, but in a cooperative way. And therein lies the tensions. Every day to now with this war, we still hear U.S. leader of the free world, U.S. leader of the West, U.S. leader of NATO. It's this leadership thing. And of course, many Americans say, Sachs, are you crazy? Of course, that's the way. I just don't have that view.
Well, in April, the Leadership Council of the UN Sustainable Development Solutions Network issued a statement asking the United Nations to do more to end the Russian war in Ukraine. Why did you feel like the UN wasn't doing enough to help bring an end to this war?
Well, the UN means two things. First of all, it means its member states. That's 193 countries. And then there is the UN system of organizations and agencies and so forth. The real political base of the UN is its members. And in two senses, there's the General Assembly, which includes all countries, one country, one vote. And then there's the Security Council. The Security Council is where war and peace issues are supposed to be addressed. There are five permanent members of the Security Council, each with a veto, the U.S., Russia, China, France, and the U.K., and then 10 rotating countries for a total of 15. So when we say the U.N. should do more, the answer to my mind is yes, but that means several different things. It means the member states. It means the U.N. Security Council. It means the leadership of the U.N. It means the U.N. agencies. The U.N. was established to end the scourge of war. Obviously, it can't do that by itself, and it doesn't do that by itself, but it is the core purpose.
You are tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
My name is John. I'm the founder of Blackout Coffee, and I started Blackout because I really love coffee. I've always loved coffee, and after traveling so much to Europe, South America, and trying so many different coffees that were so good, and every time I came back to the U.S., I was so disappointed with the coffee, so I figured that I had to do something about it. The biggest difference is on the beans and the roasting process, how we roast it, and how fresh it is. The fresher the roast, the better the quality. Here I have like all of the coffee. It's roasted within 1 to 2 days prior to being shipped. So it literally gets to consumers' house within 3 to 5 days after being roasted. If you like coffee, you have to try ours. It's fresh roasted. It's one of the best beans that we can get, and you will definitely see the difference.
Visit blackoutcoffee.com and use the coupon code REPUB10. That's REPUB10.
Here at Republic Broadcasting Network, we have been building our online store. Well, we have been focusing on bringing you the best talk show host in the country. Here at Republic Broadcasting Network, we also want our listeners to have products they can use every day and in times of emergency. We have added new products each week to our store. Your support of this network, plus products at the best prices, is a win-win situation. Check out our new store. Go to our website, republicbroadcasting.org, and click on the online store located at the top of our website. Together, we can continue to grow RBN and help our listeners prepare for the future. Go to republicbroadcasting.org. and click on our online store or call us.
800-724-2719, extension 3. 800-724-2719, extension 3.
Extendivite really works. Here's just a few testimonials from Amazon. RL, 5 stars. Been taking this for 2 months now. I feel better. Have more energy. April, my husband started taking Extendivite, and he said he feels much better and has more energy. EW, need to try. Everyone needs this for their health. Great product, great people. Josie, it works great. This product has made my blood pressure and cholesterol stable. I highly recommend it. JC, great product, has worked well these last few years. To get your Extendivite today, go to extendivite.com. That's extendivite.com. Or call us at 1-877-928-8822.
Extend your life with Extendivite.
End the scourge of war. Obviously, it can't do that by itself, and it doesn't do that by itself, but it is the core purpose. It was invented by our greatest president in the United States in our history, Franklin Roosevelt, for the purpose of surmounting the underlying reasons for World War II and World War I, the geopolitics, the arms races, the lack of global rule of law. And so ending wars, making peace, is the core business. I'm in another part of the UN activities, which is economic development, and that's important. And also the human rights side is important. But the core of the UN is about peace. And I think the UN till today is not doing enough in all of those contexts to end this war. Now, what we hear from the rhetoric in our mainstream media in the United States is, well, Putin is a Hitler, and he has to be stopped, and we have to defeat him. And it's as simple as that, and there's no talking to him. The man is crazed, living in a dream world of Russian imperialism. There's no stopping him. Any agreement is to rip up a piece of paper. I can tell you, since I'm an old guy now, 67, I've lived through this characterization. Every decade, there's a new Hitler that we can't deal with, whether it was Ho Chi Minh or whether it was Vietnam or whether it was Cambodia or Laos or Nicaragua, for heaven's sake, or Iraq or Syria. We are real good at this game of rhetoric. But this is not real. And since I am all over the world, virtually all the time, speaking with world leaders, what we hear in our media is propaganda. It is not real. We should be negotiating. Actually, Biden refused to negotiate with Putin in 2021 because Putin raised a very specific set of points. One was NATO enlargement. And then there's a chorus here that says, oh, that's a phony issue. That's a red herring. That's fake. That's not fake. I've been in this issue since 1990 when the West promised Gorbachev no NATO enlargement. We're liars. I'm sorry to put it that way. We cheated. We continued to do this. And then Biden refused to negotiate. Okay, that's straightforward, except it's not the way the story is told. Then there is the question of Ukraine itself, which is an ethnically divided country because there is a significant Russian minority. And those are real issues, by the way, although war is not an answer to them in any sense. But there was a very complicated, very difficult conflict where the U.S. was stirring the pot also back in a decade ago, and especially around 2014 and 2015. And there were actually agreements reached for the area where the fighting is raging right now, for the Donbas region. And the agreements were called the Minsk I and Minsk II agreements. They were signed by the Ukraine government. And then the government said, no, we don't want to do those. And when Putin says, well, what about the Minsk agreements? He is shouted down or ignored. No, they don't exist. They were unfair. They were this. They were that. They were actually agreements. When I say this, oh, I can only tell you how many emails I'm going to get from, Ukrainian Canadians, Ukrainian Americans. Sachs, are you crazy? What are you saying? But the truth is, diplomacy is crucial if you're going to avoid wars. Signing agreements matters. You can't just walk away from them. That's true of Russia, I'm the first to say. It's true of Ukraine also. It's true of the United States also. And so we actually should be sitting down and negotiating. And all of our media is don't discuss substance of what this war is really about or what its roots are or even what the claims of Putin are. Just say repeatedly, he's Hitler, he's a madman, he's out of control, there's nothing to do but defeat him. That's our mantra. That kind of mantra can get us all killed if we go down this road, because it's false and it's extraordinarily dangerous. Because like it or not, we don't like it, but Russia has 1,600 active nuclear warheads, and we don't even want to sit down to talk. And shame on our government not to have diplomacy with Russia. At least sit, talk, discuss, and explain. We don't do that. We just say victory, victory, victory on the battlefield. Well, I'm not in it for that, because this is a very dangerous and very unwise approach.
It's incredibly destructive, and escalating this crisis is, as you mentioned, it only gets scarier, more damaging, and more destructive from there. So what would an outcome, a reasonable outcome, be from your perspective? What if you're President Zelensky, what would you accept to get to a peaceful resolution to what's going on now?
This agreement was actually on the table back in the end of March, and then Ukraine walked away from it, from what I understand, because the U.S. told them walk away from it. We're providing the weapons, and the U.S., and even more the UK, you know, which is a more experienced empire than the US, and has a mindset, even though it's, you know, the empire is long gone, but they still have an imperial mindset that is even more imperial than our mindset. They said to the Ukrainians, don't negotiate. You don't have to. Just beat them on the field. So what was on the table at the end of March was basically neutrality for Ukraine, so that NATO and Russia wouldn't be right up against the border with each other, which is incredibly dangerous. Because if you have the two forces right up against each other, you are in a tripwire of nuclear war. We should have a zone where we're apart, where there's some time to talk, some time to work out problems for deconfliction. But no, we want it to be right up against the border. But what Zelensky said back in the end of March was neutrality. Neutrality with guarantees. Okay, that's a very valid issue. how is that neutrality going to be protected? But that was point one. Point two was something on the Donbas. Even I said, okay, Minsk one and Minsk two were signed. You can't just walk away from those agreements. You have to do something about them. The third, which is everybody, by the way, on the inside acknowledges there's no answer, is Crimea. Because Crimea is a really weird story of Russia's seaport on the Black Sea, its naval base in Sverdlovsk. So fundamental for Russian security. But Khrushchev in 1954, of course, in a what was then a completely symbolic gesture, when the Soviet Union had administrative lines that were within an overall state, he said, okay, we gift Crimea from Russia to Ukraine. It didn't mean anything when there was a Soviet army and Soviet naval base and all the rest. But after 1991, it certainly meant something. And what happened in 2014 was the pro-Russian president was overthrown. Russia views that as a U.S.-instigated coup. There is something to that, I know, actually. But again, this is one of those things that the Western media simply will not discuss. And it's so deeply hidden in classified documents that maybe in 50 years, someone will write a good book about Ukraine 2014, if we get to 50 years from now. But in 2014, the Russian president Yanukovych was overthrown. And at that moment, Putin seized Crimea. And there was a referendum, hard to know much about it, but Crimea became part of Russia. Okay, just to say, three issues on the table, neutrality, the Donbas, and Crimea. And Crimea, the basic answer was, oh my God, okay, we continue to negotiate, it's a frozen conflict. The Donbas, something like the Minsk agreements, and neutrality. And then the government of Ukraine walked away from this, even after reports that there was close to an agreement. Then we have our defense secretary and our State Department, which used to be diplomats, but now it's warriors, saying we're going to defeat Russia. And so everything went away about the negotiations. That's the long-winded answer to your question, that we weren't so far from actually having a negotiated outcome. And then Ukraine walked away, I think, under the instigation of the United States.
You know, the reason Ty and I have been such long admirers of your work and your writing is this focus on internationalism and cooperation, global cooperation, which as a show about climate change, we obviously know that global cooperation is essential to decarbonize on any kind of sustainable timeline to limit warming at 1.5 or under 2 degrees above pre-industrial levels, as outlined in the Paris Agreement. How do you think this war could have ripple effects beyond just the conflict we're seeing now? Do you think that this potentially could fundamentally reshape global politics in a way that could impact how we decarbonize around the globe?
What we're experiencing right now is a great power confrontation. So it's not merely in quotation marks, a Russian war in Ukraine or Russian invasion of Ukraine. It is a U.S.-Russia confrontation. But what's striking is that the U.S. is engaged in two fronts, one with Russia, the other with China. And we're seeing a lot of belligerency by the United States towards China in recent years as well. This started around 2014, roughly actually the time of those events in Ukraine, but really for somewhat different reasons, but are also escalating. And today there's news reports that I find, if it weren't so deadly and dangerous, I'd find it satirical. It's stories in the mainstream media saying, don't worry, the Ukraine war is not going to divert American attention from China. In other words, we're still going to have an antagonistic view to China. We're still going to make alliances in Asia. Don't worry. And this is explaining that we can do both. We can confront Russia. We can confront China. And I'm saying, oh, my God, is this for real? Do we really want World War III? Is this our death wish? Is this our insanity? Is this our craziness of our exceptionalism? But there is this feeling. We're in a two-front feeling in the U.S., and they're trying to talk NATO into opening an Asia mission. In fact, the Secretary General of NATO, Jens Stoltenberg, has said in the past year that NATO is going to direct its attention to China. Now, all of this is incredibly important for climate because China is essential for global climate policy, for cooperation, for every dimension of the climate crisis. China by itself can wreck the global climate because it emits about 28% of the greenhouse gases, in the United States about 14%. But just remember, since they're four times larger than we are in population, our per capita impact is much, much larger. But China better get this under control or we have a disaster. So are we sitting down to talk with China about this? Are we working out common systems? Are we working out technology standards? Are we agreeing to co-finance projects for decarbonization around the world? Well, I think you could probably guess the answer is no to all of those. We are changing the rhetoric regarding Taiwan. We are drumming up a drumbeat on Taiwan whenever, in the rare moments when U.S. so-called diplomats, but I don't find them very diplomatic, meet with Chinese counterparts, almost the first word out of their mouth is Taiwan. Because what they want to do is, I don't know why, but they want to annoy and provoke China and probably, and it could not be more dangerous, encourage Taiwan into some kind of adventure that would be incredibly dangerous for Taiwan. I admire Taiwan enormously. And because of that, I would keep the temperature down so that there is no tension, rather than raising the temperature, which I think can only hurt every dimension of this. Now, I was just speaking with the specialized funds around the world addressing some of the core sustainable development issues, the Green Climate Fund, the Global Environment Facility, the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, TB, and Malaria, and so forth. And what they're saying is the war in Ukraine is causing donors to say, you know what, we promised you we can't really deliver, so we're going to be late. You have to understand, we have a rising military budget. We have a crisis, refugees. Well, this is what war does. War crowds out literally survival, but it crowds out any kind of longer term thinking. And climate requires 30 years of investment in a concerted way, in a cooperative manner, in a trans-border manner. You don't decarbonize on a whim. You have to make plans. You have to invest in new power systems, power generation, transmission systems, grids that take 10, 15, 20 years to bring to fruition. So all of this makes the climate agenda fraught. And also in the short term, of course, it's bizarre. You have the Biden administration, which came into office as a climate champion, trying to raise production of fossil fuels and say, go for it, because we have to offset the production that we're trying to keep from being exported from Russia. So politically, you turn on the spigot again, rather than saying, no, you should be phasing out and phasing in something else. We say, go for it. Go for the coal, oil, and gas, because that will defeat Russia. And this is these politicians are really going to be the end of us unless we are able to get a politics that really works for our well-being, not a politics that works for their incredibly short-run horizons.
Yeah, there have been many calls in Europe and elsewhere to speed up the transition to renewable energy as a result of this war. I know you've been skeptical in other interviews that this war will actually inspire that kind of necessary action. I mean, how has the decision to end Russian fossil fuel imports impacted the clean energy transition here and abroad?
I would say again that the first thing is it just distracts, because if you want to make a transition, you need clear long-term thinking. Clear long-term thinking, at least for me, requires some quiet. You know, okay, we need to think through 10 years, 20 years, what are we going to do? But with war, it's day-to-day, it's improvisation, it's budgets that are shifted for armaments. And in a very practical way, it's reopening coal mines, reopening fracking, reopening gas fields, because you scramble in the short term when energy prices soar, which they have soared in recent weeks. And with sudden cutoffs of Russian gas, well, now Europe is taking whatever actions it can to keep the lights on to keep the air conditioning on this summer and so forth. And that means that we're not in a long-term planning mode. You could say, and there is a certain sense, well, Russia shouldn't be exporting fossil fuels for the long term. So all of this is in the direction of long-term change. And indeed, I said to Russian friends and the Russian government for years, of course you have to decarbonize. There cannot be a petro state in 2050. There can be a solar state, there can be wind power, hydropower, hydrogen economy, but there cannot be a petro state. And in a way, yes, this points in that direction. But the problem is that the transformations that we need require organization, planning, and long-term finance, and war works against all of that.
I want to switch topics quickly here because I'd love to get your thoughts on the inflation that America is facing today. How will passing parts of President Biden's Build Back Better agenda, especially the parts related to investing in the clean?
Homeowners, are you in foreclosure, expecting to be served with a foreclosure lawsuit, or suspect your lender has coerced you into an illegal mortgage transaction? A huge number of mortgages made in the last 10 years have legal issues and are possibly defective. State laws and the U.S. Supreme Court have upheld that defective mortgage documents are grounds for foreclosure defense and for counterclaims in favor of the homeowner. If your mortgage has been sold or assigned since closing the loan, it may be defective and you may be paying the wrong party, and the lender may not have standing or the right to foreclose or collect payments under the law. If you would like to know if your mortgage is legal or not, or know if you are paying the right party, we can help. Our initial consultations are free of charge. We are not attorneys. We are legal researchers and work closely with experienced lawyers who know how to help you find the evidence to help you keep your home. Call toll free 1-855-2-KEEP-IT. That's 1-855-2-KEEP-IT today.
Standing 6'4", weighing in 245 pounds of crime-fighting, political science, analyzing brawn, ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Patrick Slattery.
So, Mike, get off this anti-cicada agenda.
I'm a born-again traditional Christian, and my favorite possessions are right here on my nightstand. That would be the King James Bible and my .357 revolver.
I'd rather be ruled by Chinamen than Jews.
Cool it with the anti-Semitic remarks, right?
Just because you steal an election and terminate the republic doesn't mean you terminate the people in the republic, because we're still here.
I'm not taking the vaccine. F*** you, Bill Gates.
There was a way forward still on January 6th. What needed to be done is to object to every single state.
The COVID-19 virus was the setup. The vaccine could very well be the bioweapon.
The Patrick and Jeremy Show, Tuesday at 9 Central and Wednesday at 1 Central.
What would you say if I told you we have a new tool that will increase production and lower maintenance costs for your meat processing company, and it would pay for itself in just 6 weeks?
When pigs fly!
The new EaseOff Model EZ4 replaces old spring-style carcass droppers and is faster, safer, and more reliable. The EaseOff lowers or lifts 1,000 pounds to or from your rail automatically using our remote control.
Sounds expensive! Can I afford it?
Can you afford not to try the EaseOff? It installs fast with just 3 bolts in place of your current dropper. The effortless operation will reduce fatigue and injuries, speed up your line, eliminate downtime, and increase profit.
How can I order my EaseOff?
Go to EaseOff.com, EazeOff.com, and hurry, because we are offering $200 off on the new EZ4 for a limited time. EaseOff.com. We make pigs fly. Cows, too. EaseOff LLC, Summersville, Missouri, 417-932-6419.
I want to switch topics quickly here because I'd love to get your thoughts on the inflation that America is facing today. How will passing parts of President Biden's Build Back Better agenda, especially the parts related to investing in the clean energy transition, impact inflation?
You know, the basic point with inflation is that we have a holy mess that's come together to put us back into what's called stagflation. Higher prices, rising prices at a rapid pace, combined with an economy which is strong at the moment, but is absolutely going to slow down, maybe even have a hard landing. And worldwide, we'll have more inflation and even another downturn. Europe probably is already in a downturn because of the war hitting Europe even harder. Well, I came into economics 42 years ago when I joined the faculty at Harvard University. My first book was called The Economics of Worldwide Stagflation. It was studying this kind of phenomenon. The 1970s was a period of war. The Yom Kippur War in Israel against its Arab neighbors, for example, the Arab oil embargo, which is not so different from what's happening now. A breakdown of monetary arrangements, which were then called the Bretton Woods system, because it was under the IMF that the U.S. dollar played a particular role in international monetary affairs. So there was this incredible confluence of monetary, fiscal, geopolitical, and resource shocks that came together and produced a stagflation, which was worth writing a book about. So here we are again. We are in a stagflationary mode. Interestingly, the Federal Reserve really had pumped up the money supply for many, many years, and especially after COVID hit. In fact, in two phases, one after the 2008 Great Crunch, the financial crisis, and then again in 2020, even more remarkably in certain ways, the Fed pumped in money and nothing really happened on inflation except Bitcoin prices went up or stock market prices went up or some asset value prices went up. But prices in the street didn't seem to go up very much. And so there was the modern monetary theory. Oh, we could just print money to our heart's content. And as a monetary economist, I was scratching my head, frankly, saying, how could the money supply go up so much and not have inflation? Well, there is some mystery to that. There remains in disentangling all of this. But I would say the following. We've had a huge increase of the money supply by the Fed. We've had two huge supply shocks, COVID and the war. And the result now is that we are in an inflationary period that is painful and that is familiar in certain ways, more familiar perhaps than how macro looked two or three years ago. And what does all of this mean? It means, first of all, the world economy is unstable. That goes along with the war also. That goes along with the sanctions regime. That goes along with geopolitical tension. I don't like any of it because it makes everything much harder and it really hits poor countries very, very hard. So we're going to have a lot of debt crises coming up if we don't decisively take measures to head those off. Second, the inflation is likely to continue for a while because the underlying factors are not going to go away. Third, we need to sort out the basics. For me, the first basic is end this war. Second basic is end the taunting and the provocations of China and some specific measures like the Trump tariffs that were put on Chinese goods that raised prices, by the way, but also created a trade war. Third, I've said now, I can't tell you how many decades, if we want to fund things to make our society decent, we have to raise taxes. You can't do it by printing money, and you can't do it just by debt. So this is a third point that becomes quite important. All really important good things, like decarbonizing the energy system, are affordable by definition. We can't afford not to do them. We will completely wreck the planet. In fact, decarbonizing the energy system requires perhaps a percentage point.
Sick of censorship? TLB Talk is the cure. TLB stands for Truth, Liberty, and Balance. We are the newest and most unique social media platform to hit the internet. We were built out of necessity because big tech, big pharma, and big brother are out of control. The only thing bigger than them is when we the people are united. With that vision, TLB Talk was born. Our battlefield is in cyberspace. The battle we're in can be won by clicks of buttons and voting with your wallet. TLB Talk has no hidden agendas, no corporate funding, and we do not sell, trade, or give away any of your information. Our platform runs off of generous donations of members and merchandise profits. So please, check out our site. It's the best around. And be sure to stop by our store. It's loaded with items that'll have you feeling a sense of member pride and victory. Come unite with us today at tlbtalk.com and join the social media revolution.
RBN.
John Stadtmiller's Republic Broadcasting Network. Republicbroadcasting.org.